Attack of the Final Girls is a podcast about the horror genre, so listener discretion is advised. Please check the show notes for specific content warnings for this episode, and of course, beware of spoilers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 60 of Attack of the Final Girls. I'm Teresa.
And I'm Juliet.
And today we are covering a movie that we're going to argue about. Not the two of us, but we're going to argue with the omniscient listener that's listening to this episode right now. The world at large. The Academy. We're going to argue with the Academy about it. Because it is a movie that most of the time is not characterized as a horror movie. And that is 2010's Black Swan.
Yeah, this is going to be hitting your feeds the day after the Oscars, the 2024 Oscars. I do not think there is a single horror film or something that should be called a horror film but isn't, you know, called a horror film nominated this year. So, wah, wah.
Yeah, we're doing this one in honor of Juliet and her mom taking me to see Swan Lake. It was my second ballet I ever saw, the first one being the Nutcracker that you guys took me to see for Christmas.
Yeah.
So thanks to Juliet's mom, of course, for asking me to come, and Juliet for dragging me along to culture myself.
In a snowstorm.
In a snowstorm. I was honestly really surprised that there were so many people at that,
I know,
at that ballet, considering we were like under a snow emergency. Mm-hmm. It was slow going, y'all.
Yeah. I'm amazed we made it there on time.
And luckily, like when we got out, it was totally fine. So. Yeah. I had never seen Swan Lake before, and as we were watching it, I hadn't seen The Black Swan, like, or I guess it's just Black Swan. I hadn't seen that in a really long time either. So as we were watching Swan Lake, I was like, you know, basically connecting the dots in between. And I was like, you know what? I really want to watch that movie again. And then thinking about it in a horror movie lens, it got a lot of laurels as a movie in its own right, but it was almost never characterized as a horror movie.
Right. Despite Darren Aronofsky saying very emphatically, like, this is a psychological horror film, period. The marketing was not as such, which is often the way these things go. You know, when you have a movie, even like Jordan Peele's movies, Get Out, when you have a movie that starts to rise to that level where people outside the genre are taking notice and it starts to get, you know, noticed for awards and things like that, then all of a sudden they're trying to wipe horror out of it in terms of description. And actually, I'll link this in the show notes. NPR did a really, really surprisingly good piece about this very, very issue just this year for Oscar season, about why it is that horror continually not just gets ignored at the Oscars, but also films that rise to the level of getting Oscar noms almost always are suddenly not described as horror. Or even if they think they're going to get nominated, horror starts to be removed from the narrative about those films. So we'll get that linked up in the show notes. I felt very vindicated by that piece because that's something that we've been saying here on the podcast. It's something my partner and I talk about a lot, is this sort of erasure of the genre from high art.
Yeah, like if a movie is a horror movie, then it cannot be worthy of awards for some reason.
Right.
Or it can't be a higher level movie. It can have deeper meaning. It just has to be like slashers and, you know, Friday the 13th, which, to be fair, Friday the 13th is never going to win an Oscar.
Sure.
You know,
and that's okay.
Which is totally fine. There is absolutely room in the genre for a movie like that and just fun, like popcorn fodder versus a movie like this, which is exploring some deeper meaning. It is evoking performances by the actors and actresses that are tougher than maybe a movie that they've been in before. It honestly launched several of these actors and actresses into stardom. I know that Vincent Cassel hadn't been in a whole lot of English films prior to this. He's a French actor, so he had been in many French films, but this kind of debuted his United States run of movies, and he's been in many now. Natalie Portman, who was famous by this point in time. You know, she had been in Leon the Professional. She had been in the Star Wars movies, the prequels. But this movie really launched her into superstardom because she won Best Actress.
Only the fifth person to ever win Best Actor or Actress for a horror film ever in the Oscars.
Yeah. And, you know, being so young and relatively early in her career as well, like this was really groundbreaking. But for some reason, in spite of all of these things and in spite of the director himself who wrote the damn movie and filmed it, and this is his baby, saying this is a horror movie, people were like, no, 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 this is an art piece, you know, which I'll be honest. A lot of the times when I watch a movie, and I don't seek out Oscar-winning movies specifically, if I do watch one, it's going to be incidental to the fact that it's an Oscar nominee. But most of the time when I watch them, I'm like, this is actually good, but it is not groundbreaking. Like, there have been other movies that I've seen that have evoked a lot more emotion, or been maybe a little less bland or a little more topical. So not to say that like all of the Oscar picks are awful, but I don't know. I guess I can't relate to the choices that are made. And specifically in the case of this one, it felt like the marketing from the studio around film really downplayed the horror aspect to this movie. And because it won an Oscar, it was like we couldn't talk about it being a horror movie anymore.
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing is, I feel like that's such a bait and switch for the audience, because I can remember, based on the advertisement, my mom watched this movie. And my mom is a huge ballet fan, hence taking us to the ballet, and a huge Swan Lake fan. It's her favorite ballet. And she was like not at all expecting what she got out of this movie, because it was not marketed as a horror film. She was like, oh, wow. Oh, yikes. Okay. Like, this is not at all what I thought I was getting into.
Right. People be getting stabbed. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, drugged. They're having bad trips. And that's not Swan Lake.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, like in that NPR piece, Phil Noble from Fangoria actually kind of said the opposite thing that we've been saying. But I get his point, where he's like, well, you know, to your point about so many Oscar award-winning films feel very predictable or very rote, he was kind of saying in this NPR piece, like, you know what? It's fine that the Oscars ignore horror, because horror is supposed to push up against, you know, the norms in society and things like that. And I'm like, but can't we have both?
Yeah. Yeah. Even though we as horror fans and as a horror community have created our own awards, like we have the Chainsaw Awards, which they do a really good job of both catering to the genre and also elevating films that should absolutely deserve awards and in the award season, like deserve Best Picture or what have you, but are going to get snubbed. It still feels like a jab in the side every time they announce like all of the Oscar nominees. We're like, yep, not a single even somewhat scary film is on that list. And there are directors out there that absolutely deserve it.
Yeah.
And so it just feels like, you know, like a cold shoulder to the entire genre.
Yeah. Especially then when you have, you know, the few films that do get elevated from our world, then it's like, you know, like Parasite. They were like, oh, no, but Parasite's not a horror film. Like, have you seen Parasite?
Yeah.
Like, it's horrific on so many levels, and it does what horror does best. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I think from a fan perspective, it's like we're not sitting here saying, like, again, that Friday the 13th deserves an Oscar.
No.
What we're saying is there are films that are of that level that are representative of the best in film.
Right.
And like, let's both acknowledge that they are worthy of this award that has this cachet. And also, let's not strip the genre away from them.
Yeah.
You know, like they can be, horror can be, not all horror has to be of an Oscar worthy level, and that's okay. But the horror that does rise to an Oscar worthy level, let's call it what it is. It's horror.
Like, yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't have to be recategorized as a psychological thriller, as so many of the horror movies that, you know, get nominated are.
It's a suspense film.
Right. It's suspense. It's a psychological drama. Mm-hmm. It's a like this one was a psychological thriller that they recategorized it as. So it can be both and. It can be an Oscar worthy movie. It can be the best of its genre and also be a horror film and really scary.
Yeah.
There are many movies and many directors, I think, that have had that sort of thing stripped away from them. Not to say that directors make movies in hopes of, you know, unless it's a Oscar fodder movie, which that does happen.
Those exist.
But most of the time, a director is going to make a movie irrespective of whether or not they're going to be nominated for an Oscar. But even still, there have been so many directors that are just crapped on. And being an Oscar level movie is going to get you a viewership no matter.
Absolutely.
There's going to be that realm of people who are like, oh, this was nominated for an Oscar, so I must watch it ahead of Oscar season.
Mm-hmm.
And those movies are going to be robbed of that. And I think that that's a challenge for a viewer of only Oscar, you know, level movies or nominees. If you don't get to have this wide variety of film, then you're limiting yourself, basically.
Yeah. My colleague and I were having a conversation about this in regards to music, but I think it's applicable here. Not all art has to make you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
And sometimes the best art has you sit in discomfort. And horror is really good at that.
Yeah.
You know, and not always in an exploitative or, you know, kind of icky, gory way. Like, horror can make you very uncomfortable and make you think the big thoughts. And I think that's not recognized by people outside the genre as much as it should be.
So here's an interesting dichotomy. One of the reasons, and I think that they mentioned this in the NPR article about Oscars kind of snubbing horror, is that horror movies have a tendency to have violence or like gore in them, which is okay. Like,
yeah,
they absolutely can. But think about a war movie.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Or Killers of the Flower Moon.
Right.
You know, Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
These movies have, you know, big, serious, violent, you know, implications here, and those two movies in particular are about real life violence.
Right.
Real shit that happened to real people.
Incredible violence.
Yeah.
You know, war movies, like, let's talk about Saving Private Ryan, has swept the Oscars.
Yeah.
And there are men crawling up, you know, Normandy Beach with limbs blown off, pieces of their heads missing, blood, gore, violence. And those movies are like, yes, yes, war movies, great. This is, you know, not to say anything bad about war movies. I personally don't like to partake in them, but not to say anything bad about them. But that somehow is classified, no, good, Oscar, good. This is going to get Best Picture, as where a movie about, you know, something horrific or a fantastic thing, and you've got a dude whose arm has come off or gore or guts or something.
Yeah.
But somehow that, no, poo-poo on that. That's not worthy of an Oscar. It's just strange how we categorize that violence as being like, oh, this is based on real life, so it's okay. But this is based off of a story, so it is not okay and not worthy.
Right.
So strange.
Yeah.
Like, how can we compartmentalize that? Like, somehow this violence based off of real life is glorious, but this violence based off of a story or based in fiction is disgusting.
Yeah.
How do we as viewers, not us particularly, but as, you know, the general movie watching public, how do we justify that? And how is it that the Oscars now have somehow become the Academy has become an organization that reinforces that weird idea?
Mm-hmm. And horror can only exist in the best visual effects category.
Yeah, or like soundtrack or like something weird, like the stuff that they don't show on TV. Mm-hmm. Like, it has to be down low, and then maybe they're gonna get that.
Yeah, because that is the one horror nominee this year, is Godzilla Minus One, which better win.
Another movie so deserving of so much more.
Yeah,
like a movie that transcends creature feature and horror film and real life like drama into this perfect synergy of the three types of movie, and yet it's got nominated for visual effects. Not actor, not picture, not actress, not supporting, none of those things. Not sound, like, holy shit, if you haven't seen it. I know that this is not the Godzilla Minus One episode, but if you haven't seen it and you get the opportunity to see it on the big screen, please go see it, because it is absolutely fantastic. And that movie didn't get nominated for shit.
Yeah.
And it is baffling to me. And that isn't even a movie where there are traditional horror tropes. Like, it totally could have been sanitized to the point where the Academy could have been like, yes, we'll nominate that for actor, supporting actor, whatever. But instead, it's getting pushed down into these minor categories that nobody really cares about. Like, not to say that they're not worthy, but let's be honest, people don't go down that far on the Oscar billing to see what the hell won Best Visual Effects. They're like, oh, okay. No, it's actor, picture, supporting actor,
Director.
Those are the things that people give a shit about.
Yeah.
And this movie deserved to be nominated for every single one of them, and yet it's not showing up there.
Yeah.
The number one Godzilla movie of all time, the number one Japanese release film in the United States of all time, completely decimated everybody's expectations of it. That could be your absolute poster boy for a movie that deserved all of the award nominations and got none.
Yeah.
Or one.
Yeah.
Woof. You just made me all pissed off again.
every year, Oscar season, we just get angry.
Yeah, we've created our own community for horror movies so that we can give the laurels to these films because it totally deserves it. It just hurts to see movies get snubbed that are truly incredible films simply because it's got a creature in it or it's labeled as a horror movie or has Godzilla in the title.
Yeah.
Very frustrating.
Very much so.
Ugh. Okay. So to talk more specifically about Black Swan, now that we've gotten it all out of our system.
Yeah. Whew. Okay.
Yeah. Relaxed now.
Yeah. We're good.
I'm just going to light a candle over here and calm us down. So this movie, when it came out, really the marketing around the film and I guess the subject matter, because you typically think of ballet to be a soft or more gentle art, you know. Even the famous ballets like Swan Lake, which can, in some retellings of the story or some, I guess, more faithful tellings of the story, can be very tragic, is still beautiful.
Yes.
And this movie ends up being hard and violent, which is something that is kind of a juxtaposition to ballet.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting to note that Darren Aronofsky originally conceived this idea as being a part of the movie The Wrestler, where he actually wanted to tell a story about a wrestler and a ballet dancer to talk about the sort of parallels, you know, the athleticism, the wear and tear on the body and the mind and the spirit to create an experience for an audience, which both wrestlers and dancers do, you know, as their livelihood, the sort of expiration date on a person's career, and then the sort of what's next when you've spent your entire young life molding your body to do this one thing and then you can't do it anymore. And I think that could have been a really good movie. That said, he realized there was so much to mine with both professions that he split them into two movies. And you'll see a lot of parallels between these two movies still. The Wrestler going more into a traditional drama space. And I love that movie so much, even though I like can't watch it because it hurts my heart too much. That's one of those, like, I can watch it like once every 10 years without just losing my shit. And then Black Swan going into a more horror space, doing what Aronofsky really became known for, which is taking the psychological and manifesting it visually. You know, we see that in Requiem for a Dream. Really, The Wrestler was one of his more literal movies. One of the more straightforward, most straightforward movies he has ever made. Black Swan was really going back to what he was known for, which is like manifesting the deeply psychological with visual. And I think it's great. I love the way he pulls that off, but it's really interesting to see how they branched off from each other, those two films.
Yeah, like even more specifically, like the body horror of being a performer.
Yes.
The sacrifices that you make in this movie, we get more eating disorders, the wear and tear on your body as a ballerina, which I think a lot of people miss that aspect of being a ballerina. They think they're beautiful, they're dainty, they're delicate, they're gorgeous, you know. But they're also like breaking toenails and dislocating toes, breaking toes, having like disgusting things happen to their feet and ankles. And they have to stay really thin. So they're, well, they don't have to stay really thin. I guess traditionally we expect ballerinas to be thin and dainty. Although I think that that is sort of going the way of the dodo now because we're realizing like, wow, all bodies deserve to be healthy. Mm-hmm. We should not like starve ourselves in order to be whatever like picture.
Oh, and there's so much like inherent, you know, not just the body issues, but, you know, the racism involved. The timing of this has been perfect because I actually just re-listened to one of Misty Copeland's interviews on Fresh Air about one of her memoirs. And she talks at length about actually taking on the role of the Swan Queen in Swan Lake as a Black woman, you know, as one of not the first ever sort of premier black ballerina, but as one of the first, and as somebody who had all eyes on her, not just because she was a dancer, but because she was a black dancer.
Right.
And sort of all of the inherent racism that goes into, you know, traditional ballet costuming and movement and body expectations, and how by her very existence she defied that, and the challenges therein. I like that this movie, although it doesn't get into the racial aspect at all, does shine a light on, you know, all of the things, the real kind of horrific human things that go into making this beautiful thing on the stage, you know, this very beautiful, graceful thing that looks very charming and sparkly and lovely, and, you know, what people have to do to their bodies to achieve that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because there was some real life body horror that happened that had to parallel the body horror that's occurring in this movie. And I absolutely think that it's classified as body horror. I mean, we might not be pushing a Cronenberg situation here, but there was some really like rough things to watch. So in real life, specifically, Natalie Portman kept having issues with her toe. So like some of the point dancing and like toe work that she had to do in this movie, she couldn't because of that toe. She also dislocated a rib. So some of the lifts that you have to do where the male dancer will kind of lift by the rib cage, she couldn't do those because of that dislocated rib. It took a really long time for her to heal from that. And in the movie, we see she has an eating disorder. We don't really get a whole lot of backstory on that. We just kind of see that it's there. We don't see her eating that much in the film. It seems like her mom and her both like, in a terrible, awful way, are more concerned about her weight than anything else. And in real life, Natalie Portman had to lose 20 pounds in order to participate in this role. And she's already very small. She's 5'5", so my height. And to lose another 20 pounds, you can really see it. It's very evident in her face when she's acting in this film. It's just weird that we get exposed to the real life body horror of being a ballerina, and then also this actress had those things happen to her in the process of making this film. Like, I would never want to do that. I would never want to put myself through that. But she really experienced some really terrible stuff in the course of this movie.
I really appreciate that this film acknowledges that the character had an eating disorder, but didn't go into the whole thing of it, presented it as one of many things that this character was dealing with to, you know, achieve her dream of being a dancer, because I think that it would be a less compelling film if that, if, you know, that was all it is. And I think it would be really easy to just make the movie we expect about a dancer with an eating disorder who's trying to be perfect, and not to reduce that experience at all, but I think to really see that she's purging alongside, you know, she has this kind of compulsive, like, scratching situation that's happening. Her mother is terribly abusive, and I want to talk more about her mother later. She's got this perceived rivalry with the other women around her that I think, you know, we can go back and forth about whether that's reality or her perception because of everything she's dealing with. She's got, obviously, the horribly manipulative ballet guy, Vincent Cassel's character, who's disgusting and is like, you know, the Me Too poster boy. But I like that we get to see, with Aronofsky's skill at visuals and sort of manifesting the psychological, not one thing in isolation, but that we get to see all of the factors bearing down on this person, you know, and not just, you know, oh, it sucks, you know, that she had to lose weight. And again, not to reduce eating disorders, but I just think to really see the whole picture of what this person is dealing with makes it a much more compelling and disturbing film.
So if we saw this movie in a neurotypical person's brain, then we would see, like, basically what you described, sort of like a documentary of the trials and tribulations of being a ballerina, the things that you put your body through. But if you're neurotypical, then you're going to, like, have this beautiful thing that happens at the end of all of this suffering, and then it's going to be worth it to you. Or that's what you're striving for, you know, is to have this, you know, beautiful production, and you're one of the stars in it, and you feel really good, and that makes it worthwhile to you.
Yeah,
In this case, though, we're not dealing with someone who's neurotypical. There's been a lot of speculation about the mental illness that Nina's character has in this movie, but I'm not even going to speculate because who knows. But that's where we get this horrific thing, is that there's not a good, solid neurotypical background there.
Yeah.
There's something that's going on in her mind that has worn her down to this point, and she's ground down to a point where these outside pressure factors are now affecting her to the point where she's hallucinating. She's not having good relationships with her mom, which in the past, you know, ostensibly she's been having good relationships with her mom. To your point, as we were watching the movie, she's infantilized.
Yeah.
I think she mentioned she's 28, or she's in her 20s at some point, and she's still, you know, living in this pink bedroom, and her mom is still doing everything for her and keeping tabs on her, feeding her, choosing what she eats, what she wears, how she styles her hair, undressing her at the end mm-hmm. of an evening, an important evening for Nina. So all these things are like now getting to the point where she's crumbling under the pressure, because she's a ballerina. She's been a ballerina for a long time. She's been in productions. Obviously, we know she's in the New York Ballet. Like, she's no stranger to pressure. But this one in particular has caused her to collapse.
Yeah.
And things kind of spiral from there. So I think that that's a really interesting aspect of it, is to bring to it this aspect of this person is not okay mentally. And now all of these external factors are making it so she can't cope.
Yeah.
With this normal amount of pressure. Although that's an extremely high level of pressure.
Yeah.
That normal people would never see for someone who participates in the ballet, a normal level of pressure. And now it's like completely different.
Right. Because if you've chosen, you know, performance of any kind as your career, your calling, there is an amount of pressure to be expected, you know, and you become used to that. And yes, certainly, you know, as we see in this film, there are situations where there is more pressure added on to, you know, the pressure of rehearsing and preparing to perform art in front of people. You know, there are abusive personalities at the heads of this. The director's character was based off of George Balanchine, who was, by all accounts, a complete monster. So certainly there are other personalities there that can make that pressure more than the average pressure. That said, the infantilization is so interesting to me because, as I was telling you when I was watching the film, dancers that start as pre-professional, as teenagers, have to be very independent to make it as far as they can. I know folks who have teenagers who are training to be dancers, and these are young people who travel on their own and live on their own away from their families so that they can start training with a company and accepting roles, and so that they are ready as soon as they are 18 to step onto a professional stage. So to have Nina kind of, you know, very coddled with her mother is out of the ordinary already. And I think that's why Lily feels like such an extreme to her. Like, and yes, her character's amped up a little bit. She's sassy, she's smoking, whatever. But Lily is the more typical picture of a ballerina. She's independent. She was in San Francisco. She's doing stuff on her own. She's in charge of her own life, not just as an adult, but as an adult professional who has come up in a professional system. Whereas Nina is just oddly repressed and left behind in a lot of ways. And it sets her apart from her peers.
Yeah. I want to bring up her mom, too, because yeah. I feel like Barbara Hershey's portrayal of Nina's mom really like gave me Piper Laurie and Carrie vibes.
Oh, yeah.
Like yes. If Natalie Portman was pyrokinetic, she would have like Nina fully would have been like setting shit on fire. There were so many parallels without the religious aspect, because that was sort of Piper Laurie's driver in Carrie, was like she was uber religious. But Barbara Hershey's character is like that without religion. Like, it just goes to show you that you can be a controlling and terrible and like reductive and hold your child back without having to do with God at all.
Yeah.
It was simultaneously like this narcissism that her mom is living vicariously through her, because we learned through the course of the film that her mom was also a dancer and that she had to end her career in order to have Nina. But at the same time, like, she's pressuring her about her food intake. She's flipping out when Nina doesn't want to eat cake, because Nina has an eating disorder. So, of course, she's not going to want to eat cake. And she does actually say, like, my stomach is still in knots, which, fair. If you don't want to eat stupid cake, ballerina cake, you don't have to eat the stupid ballerina cake.
Exactly.
She's a whole ass adult. She should be allowed to make the choices about her own food. But then her mom, like, has this epic level freak out and is like, ah, screw it. I'm just going to throw it away then.
Yeah.
But instead, she's like, no, no, no. It's just, like, I'm still upset a little bit and I'm, like, nervous or whatever. And, like, pacifies her mom because she has to be the one to corral her mom's emotions.
Oh yeah,
she absolutely has to be the healer of that, even though her mom was the one being unreasonable. So really, really interesting dynamic there, because she's also keeping her daughter in an apartment where, not that she's not allowed to leave, but she's tracked all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Tabs are kept on her. Her phone only ever rings when her mom is calling. All of her decorations and clothes and everything are, like, white or pink, not becoming of an adult woman.
Yeah, like, she's a grown-ass woman. And her mom is like, oh, you can't go out. You can't do this. You can't do that. It's like, ew, no.
Yeah.
No.
It's just a really interesting character to put in here. Of all of the people exerting pressure on Nina, for her mom to also be doing that and for Nina to never be getting any privacy, it was really interesting to see that she doesn't have a place where she's allowed to let her hair down and be herself.
Yeah. And obviously that comes out in her dancing. That's sort of the whole thing at the beginning of the film, is that she can't sort of become uninhibited in her dancing in the way that she needs to for the role of the Black Swan. But I made that observation too, that, you know, she kind of has no space for her own mind except for when she's dancing. And even then, she's so all consumed with being perfect, she can't just be and exist in her skin and in the movement and in the music and all of that.
Yeah, she doesn't have any confidence in herself.
Yeah.
She's either pressured to please her mom or pressured to please this sadistic director. And that comes through in her dancing. She's striving to be perfect and hit every single mark and do all the moves exactly how they're supposed to be done. And the director keeps telling her, forget that. Don't worry about perfection. Lose yourself. Be in love with this role. Like, show me your passion. It doesn't have to be perfect if you can emote, which I think is, like, breaking her down, because all she's ever wanted to do is be perfect.
Right.
And now this director, who has been probably the one saying, like, be perfect, be better.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's saying, don't do that. Like, look at Lily, who I was reading several Reddit articles and everybody kept calling her Oda Lily, which I thought was funny because, like, the Black Swan character is called Odile in,
yeah,
you know, in Swan Lake. But she isn't perfect. She's smiling. She's laughing. She's having fun. But it's because ballet comes naturally to her. And Natalie Portman's character, it doesn't. She, like, has to work for it. And so Vincent Cassel's character is like, no, show me, like, seduce me with your dancing. Like, show me what that's like. And Natalie Portman just can't do it for a long time. It's very fascinating because we think when you're a ballerina, you need to be perfect. You need to hit all those marks. Like, in Swan Lake especially, there are several choreographed sequences where if you're out of sync with the other dancers, you're going to mess everything up.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to look like shit.
Yeah.
But in this case, Vincent Cassel being the director and saying, like, he wants to do a stripped down version of Swan Lake, which, not to speak ill of this obviously fake production, but, like, it doesn't really look stripped down to me. It looks pretty typical for a Swan Lake production. At least it mirrored a lot of what we saw.
Yeah.
He's like, no, you know, show me your passion. Show me this. And she's like, what do you want? Like, you said be perfect and now you're saying don't be perfect.
Well, and that is the challenge of every artist as they are developing, is, you know, technical precision versus the artistry of the art, you know, and that thing that makes art special that can't be taught, you know, it just has to come from within you. But I think, moreover, it's like that is also just the experience of, like, anybody who grew up as an, air quotes, like, gifted student, is you have this point, and there are, you know, 1,000 TikToks about this. You have this point where you've been told your whole life, like, you know, be perfect, be good, get straight A's or whatever your thing is. Be good at your sport, be good at whatever. And then you come into the world and you realize you don't know how to be a person.
Right.
Like an actual, like, functioning human. Like, you're good at this one thing and you're really, really freaking good at it, but you don't know how to exist otherwise.
Right. And there's also that pressure to continue to be the top at whatever you're doing.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Where, like, you can't turn yourself off.
Right.
So there was, like, this thing I think you sent me a little while ago about, like, the number of emails that people will respond to. Like, the average is 60%, that people will only respond to 60% of the emails that require a response.
And I'm squirming in my chair right now because that makes me uncomfortable, because that's right. Not, you have to check all the boxes.
Right, exactly. So, like, for kids that were like, oh, you're a gifted kid, we're like, oh no, we have to do 100%. So yeah. If there's one email that goes unread, one email that you have to push to Monday because you can't get to it on Friday, you're like, oh God, this you're is like, the worst.
I am capital B bad at everything.
Yeah. And Nina does this in this movie. Like, she falls at the beginning of her final performance. She, like, busts her knee. The other dancer's like, what the fuck? Like, what are you doing? And she is ashamed. It just adds on to the mental pileup that she has. She's late to her own, like, opening performance, which, like, poo-poo on that, right? And she's already been late to some of her rehearsals, her final, like, dress rehearsals. She was late to that. She was late to her own opening performance. And so now she's got this, like, extra layer where she's not perfect. She messed up. And it, like, adds to that mental stress of her breakdown.
Yeah.
So really, really fascinating to kind of see that increase of mental torment over the course of this movie, where she's like, perfect, 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 perfect. And then she's got this director that's like, not perfect, not perfect. You don't have to be perfect. And she's like, but I have to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's not. And she's like, oh, shit, I'm like, I can't do this.
Right.
We talked a little bit during the course of this movie about how this kind of echoes, like, it gives some Suspiria vibes.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about the old school Suspiria versus new Suspiria, Dakota Johnson's Suspiria, and also some of the other, like, Italian film parallels that this movie has.
Mm-hmm.
And not just Italian movies. I also want to talk about Perfect Blue a little bit, which I know you haven't seen, so I'm going to keep it, like, top level. But I feel like this movie echoes so many other movies. But Darren Aronofsky has been, like, pretty close-lipped about it.
Yeah.
Like, there are actual scenes in this movie that are exactly like scenes in Perfect Blue. But he was like, no, that's not one of my... So, and Perfect Blue is largely considered to be a horror film, too. Like, yes. A psychological horror film. So I wonder the inspirations that he has. I mean, Suspiria is not about Swan Lake, but it is about ballet.
Yeah.
And there's lots of mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
Something Argento does a lot is he will show the progression of a character in their clothes, in the clothes that they wear.
Yes.
Which we definitely see in Nina. She starts the movie wearing only white and pink, and she ends the movie wearing gray, black, that kind of thing. So I wanted to get kind of more of what you thought about the parallels between this and Suspiria.
You know, there's the obvious, they're both about ballet and the pressures therein. But I think the kind of interesting thing to look at is I read a theory that somebody had, and I'll link this article in the show notes, about whether Nina's situation was psychological or whether it was possession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, Suspiria takes it a little literally, both versions, but I think that there are moments in Suspiria as the story is unfolding in both the Argento version and the 2018, I think, version, where you are wondering, is this witches or the devil or whatever? Or is this person just cracking under the pressure? You know, mm-hmm. Is this just the pressure of this person being in a new space that is very, very demanding and trying to do this thing that is physically demanding, and, you know, there are all these different things happening. And I feel like in that regard, there are so many parallels, because we spend half this movie wondering, like, what's going on with Nina? Is she having a mental break? Is there magic involved? Is the figure of Rothbart that she sees throughout the film, is that like the devil or
right.
Something like, what's going on? And I think you could really make the argument either way with this movie. You know, Suspiria really does spell it out and is like, no, there is some supernatural stuff afoot.
Right.
But I think this movie does sort of set up that same expectation where you're like, okay, here's this person who's going through it. And with some of the imagery, we're getting that same kind of, is this all interior or is it exterior influencing the interior kind of a thing?
I think it's really interesting that you brought up the Rothbard thing too, because Rothbard in this movie and the version of Swan Lake that we just recently saw didn't have him characterized this way.
No, not at all.
But I guess in a lot of like more Russian inspired versions of Swan Lake, productions of Swan Lake, Rothbart will look like an owl or a raven. Mm-hmm. Because I guess traditionally in their folklore, like owls and ravens are bringers of ill will. So that's why they would characterize him that way. And sometimes they'll have him wearing like a half mask where it just looks like the top half of him is, you know, more evil, I guess. So interesting, though, that Rothbard is kind of characterized in that way, because it looks like he's a demon. He fully looks like, if you've watched Mulholland Drive, like the scary person yes. behind the dumpster at Winkies that causes that dude to have a heart attack and die. Mm-hmm. That's what Rothbart looks like.
Yeah.
And the photos that you see in throughout the movie look like that too. And Rothbart is like the evil, like stepdad kind of character, like the prince's mom's new husband who's like, you got to get married, you got to get married, even though his mom was also like putting pressure on him. So in the story of Swan Lake, although it can be portrayed in many different ways and kind of the ending can be different, mm-hmm. like sometimes it's really tragic and sometimes it's like happy, depending on the producer, I guess, or the director of the ballet. There's lots of parallels between the story of Swan Lake and the story that's happening in Black Swan, like with Rothbart. There's an absent father character in this case. There's like this evil male influence on our main character. And also we've kind of been, I guess, refocused from the prince being the main character to Nina. And in this case, we have Nina playing both the Swan Queen and the Black Swan, which that also doesn't always happen in certain productions.
Yeah, so it's very company dependent. It's considered on the one hand a traditional way to go, but it's not necessarily the original way that the ballet was staged. So different companies do it differently.
So there's a lot of like supernatural influence on Nina, where like we hear these whispers and she's having these visions. She's seeing herself and many other people that she's just walking by, other dancers around her. So she's like seeing this evil version of herself all the time as well as Rothbart. So interesting that we have that kind of like external sort of Italian, like what's actually happening? Is she really like cracking? Is she seeing herself and other people? It seems very like heavily Italian horror influenced.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
All the mirrors, like obviously yeah. ballet is like a pretty mirror heavy thing. There's mirrors all over the place when you're practicing, that is. And there's also like these shattered mirrors that she's seeing. You know, there's a mirror, sort of this like Art Deco mirror that her mom has in her apartment that she sees herself in all the time. She's constantly in bathrooms, which that was another thing I wanted to bring up, is the fact that she only ever has time to herself in bathrooms.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But she's always in bathrooms, like seeing her own reflection, seeing like weird things where her reflection doesn't sync up with her. But I'll roll into the bathroom thing, because the only times when Nina ever has time to herself in this entire movie is when she's in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, absolutely.
You know, she like has this eating disorder where she's getting sick in the bathroom, but she's by herself. When she's at home, she doesn't have privacy in her own bedroom. So she goes into the bathroom and puts the laundry hamper in front of the door, and she has time by herself. There's even a part, I think, when she gets her own bathroom, when she goes into the like lead,
dressing room.
She has time to herself there. So it's interesting that the only time that she ever is really like by herself and has privacy is when she's in the bathroom, even though her mom is still trying to like crack into that privacy.
Ugh, I know.
Her mom is nuts. I want to bring up the sort of inciting incident, which I think leads to Nina's downfall, of Lily and Nina going out to party.
Yeah.
So I think that we're supposed to think during the course of this film that Lily is sort of an antagonistic character, and that she's like edging for Nina's role, and like she's the cool, like she's got hold of her sexuality and mm-hmm. seems like very self-sustained and all that stuff. But to me, in watching this movie the second go around, this is only the second time I've ever seen it, I didn't really see that Lily was an antagonistic character at all.
Right. So I think that we are meant to question that throughout the entire film. And obviously we learn that that's not the case. This is all in Nina's head. And it seems to me, and we never get this explicitly stated in the film, but I'm just going to use my context clues here, that Nina's mother warned her about other women.
Uh-huh.
You know, that they're all your rivals and right. they're all out to get you. And it's that thing where, you know, women are pitted against each other. You know, we just had International Women's Day. So I'm thinking about this, that sort of traditional thing that women must be rivals, you know, whether it's for the attention of men or a role or whatever, that we are always in competition with each other. And I think that's what Lily is set up to represent, is that expectation that we are always in competition with each other. And really, she's just trying to be a good friend.
Yeah.
I don't even want to say she's rough around the edges. She's just a different person than Nina.
Right.
And she just approaches the world a little differently. But she's honestly very good to Nina throughout in her own way. You know, even the drugging of the drink, which, you know, it, do not recommend. You know, right. I'm not endorsing that behavior at all. At her core, she is the one doing it. She is taking care of the drink from the guys. You know, she's not letting the guys do it. She is in control of that. And she's wanting this person to have fun and let loose.
Right.
Questionable methods. I get it. But I don't think her intentions are ever nefarious.
Yeah. Yeah. The definite vibe that I get from Nina and the other women in this company is that she is isolated.
Yeah.
And it's like a self-isolation. Not that nobody wants to be her friend, although, I mean, it happens in any friend group or any group of people that are kind of forced together that isn't natural, you know, like school or whatever.
Yeah.
You're always going to have people where you're like, yeah, I don't really like that person. Or yeah, that person really annoys me or whatever. But she doesn't have any friends.
Right.
So then you have this outside person come in and be like, oh, I don't know, you know, that I'm not supposed to talk to this person, that she's weird or whatever, that she's not, doesn't want to be my friend. I don't know that. So I'm just going to try and be supportive. I'm the new girl. So of course she's going to extend more olive branches than probably somebody who's been there for years and years. Because why make yourself uncomfortable in a new situation?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you're supposed to be there to work, but also, like, that doesn't mean that you can't have friends or talk right. to other people or try to be friendly and make the best out of that situation. I think an interesting thing, too, is the impression that I got from the scene where Lily is drugging the drink is that Nina saw that.
Right.
She saw that she put the drugs in the drink.
Yeah.
And then she chose to take the drink.
Yes.
So for her to come back later and be like, you put something in my drink, like, you saw it.
Oh,
you,
she did.
You watched her do that. There was no switcheroo that happened. And she confirmed with Lily before she drank it, just a few hours, right?
Right. Exactly.
So like she was aware of that. But another thing I find interesting is that some folks think that Lily is gaslighting Nina about the night that they spent together. Because when Nina wakes up, the bar is gone from the door, like it's a little ajar.
Oh.
So they think that Lily is gaslighting her and then makes her feel humiliated about the night that they spent together. And you could totally read it either way.
You could.
You know, like Nina being ashamed of the feelings that she's having for this person and sort of her own sexual awakening, which, not to say that this is like a strange awakening, there definitely can be some situations where you're like, I've been with men and it's unfulfilling.
Right.
Let's try this. It's a common thread, you know? It's interesting to read it in both of those ways. Like, did Lily really have this evening with Nina and then she's just gaslighting her about it and making her feel like shit afterwards? And then, like, how does that read with Lily coming to her door afterwards and saying, like, I just wanted to tell you that you're doing really good and I really liked your performance. And then Nina killing her.
Right.
In her mind, anyways. or did that really not happen? Did they really, like, part ways after the bar and Nina is just feeling, like, very guilty about this fantasy that she had?
I don't know. Because I think the argument could really be made either way. And I think the interesting thing is, although Lily gives her a little shit about it, she doesn't straight up reject the idea of them being together.
Right.
You know, I think it's, my read of it was more like she teases her about it and then she kind of pauses when Nina is panicking, like when she says, oh, did you have a lesbian wet dream about me, kind of joking. And then and maybe I'm reading too much into it, sort of recognize Lily going, oh shit, maybe this person is attracted to me. Okay, I'm going to make her feel less uncomfortable by just being like, oh, was I any good? You know?
Yeah.
And again, like, there's a lot of care in that.
Right.
Like, you know, oh, I'm going to joke with somebody. Oh, I've hit a nerve. I'm going to back off and I'm going to try to, you know, dispel the tension here.
Right. Yeah, because on the one hand, you could see that as Lily sabotaging Nina. Like, she drugged her the night before her big premiere. She says it's only going to last for a few hours, but we all know, like, MDMA, ecstasy, whatever, which I think in this case it's supposed to be MDMA. Like,
yeah,
sure, it might only last for a couple of hours, but you probably shouldn't do anything crucially important immediately afterwards. Like, granted, I've never done it before, but I also would not be like, I'm going to have this amazing job interview that's like super crucial. And then the first time I trip on MDMA, be like, okay, yeah, let me do this the night before a really important day.
Do that when you've got the job.
Right. Or like, you know, give yourself a weekend or something to decompress afterwards and like process your experience. That's like, I would say responsible, like first time drug use.
Yeah.
Maybe just like give yourself some space and a trip sitter who's also not partaking of it.
Yeah.
But in this case, Nina's like, oh, yeah, I have this incredibly important, super stressful thing I'm going to do. And my mom's driving me nuts. Let me go out with this girl, drink when I don't normally drink, and then, you know, trip.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting scene because that seems like the catalyst for everything that happens afterwards. The fact that she thinks that she's murdered, you know, Lily, and then we find out that she didn't, that it was just in her head, and really she's done the harm to herself. It's just a fascinating scene where you can see it from these two totally different parallel kind of experiences, and neither are necessarily wrong. It's infrequent that you see a situation like that where you could see like both of those things being totally reasonable and fair.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's like one is the mirror image of the other. Like one is the dark mirror image of the light. Like Lily totally could have had like fully good intentions. And she's like, oh, I'm trying to be a friend and like loosen this girl up because she's, you know, she's so tightly wound.
Yeah.
And she's so upset and I want to be nice to her. But the way that I am chill and nice to my friends is I offer them this recreational drug.
Right.
And try to get them with these two dudes because like, of course, let's loosen up with like a baby Sebastian Stan, which he's so sweaty in this movie.
I know, he really is.
Like pre-Winter Soldier. But she's from San Francisco, which like, whatever. I don't know. Like, they're wild and loose out there, I guess. And they're like, let's just like have, you know, nameless, faceless sex with these two dudes and also do drugs in the hopes that tomorrow we're feeling better.
Right.
And then like we have some of this like tension kind of expelled from us and we can feel more comfortable and relaxed and less nervous. That works for some people.
Right.
And maybe like Lily was totally just trying to be a good person and help her colleague out. Because she's dancing in the program, too. Like, Lily is also dancing, but she's also her backup. So then Nina just assumes that there's, like, this sort of nefarious purpose behind it. Like, oh, you know, we were supposed to be together, but maybe it was just a fantasy. And now I feel bad about that. I feel guilty. And I feel guilty that I took drugs. And now I'm having, like, these after effects. I've already been seeing shit even before I did drugs. And now I'm seeing more shit.
Yeah.
I'm seeing like these evil things. I'm hearing voices and stuff. So it's a very fascinating scene. And everybody was just like, lesbian sex in a movie. and now we're getting, you know, it's Oscar bait or whatever. And now it's like in the lens of being 14 years after this movie was released, it's like, this was actually not that groundbreaking in terms of like lesbian sex scenes.
So on IMDb, on the little like content ratings things, one of the things they say is that on the parent's guide, sex and nudity severe. And I'm like, really? Because there's like not really any nudity in this film. And the sex scene in air quotes was fully clothed.
Yeah.
But it was two women. Huh.
Yeah. That's weird.
And there's some very, very mild, very tastefully done masturbation scenes.
Yeah.
Where, again, like, you have to kind of know what's going on to know what's going on.
Right. also, like, is this a movie that you should let your kids watch? No, it's like, right. Just don't let your kids watch it.
Don't let your kids watch anything by Darren Aronofsky. I'm just God, saying.
No. Oh my God. Yeah. I forgot to tell this story. Let me talk about kids not watching Darren Aronofsky. So the reason I am the way I am is one of my best friends in high school loved Darren Aronofsky. He mm-hmm. loved, specifically, he loved Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, no.
Because this didn't come out until I was out of high school. So yeah. I didn't watch it for a while. But we watched Requiem for a Dream so many times because I had a crush on this dude.
Oh, no.
In high school. So I was like, oh, no. Well, I want to watch this movie all over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. It broke my brain, I think.
Yeah.
I think that is why I am the way I am, is because of Requiem for a Dream. Like, watching Ellen Burstyn and Jared Leto's performance in that, you cannot tell me that is not a horror movie. Like,
oh,
you can,
yeah,
you
it
can
is.
Like, do not, you can miss me with that shit, because it is 100% horrific. Not only did I watch that movie a kajillion times, I recently rewatched it, and a friend of mine who was here to watch it with us, like, had to go home because he was so affected by this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the extremes that these people would go mm-hmm. through. And, like, it kind of is gut turner, and it's not even really violent. Like, it is violent in parts. It's just the parts that, like, wrench you are not the violent parts.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like, this is way too close to home, and we're portraying these, like, really mm-hmm. real scenarios of people who are just trying to grasp for something better and then, like, failing and failing down, basically. And, like, all of the nasty, terrible shit that happens to them, even though they don't deserve it. Yeah, I broke my brain.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that movie should only be viewed sparingly. And it's an excellent, excellent movie.
Yeah.
But it should only be viewed sparingly. I mean, I feel that way about most of his films, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Like, even The Fountain, which I also love. Yeah.
It breaks my heart.
Yeah. His movies, I can only watch them, like, after long periods.
That's supposed to be a movie that's happy too, that has, like, a good ending.
Oh God. The movie is gut-wrenching.
Yeah, it's fully sad.
Yeah,
but, like, Mother, oh my God, I don't even know if yeah. I can ever watch that movie
yeah.
again. It just breaks my brain. But yeah, don't let your kids watch Darren Aronofsky movies. If they're a teenager, maybe The Wrestler, but like you need to be there to kind of, like, talk about it.
Yeah, maybe start with The Wrestler and The Fountain.
Yeah,
and work up to the other ones.
Holy shit, man. Yeah, you definitely should not watch Black Swan as a child. So, like, the sex is, like, incidental,
right?
It's just like topics that are, I don't know that most teenagers could grasp exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
So, like, the sex is kind of incidental to, like, why they shouldn't watch it.
Right. Right. There's so many other reasons.
Yeah. And, you know, 2010, yeah, we probably didn't have a lot of lesbian sex in movies, especially not in, like, widely released films. We had The L Word. So, like, HBO was producing, like, lesbian sex in TV.
Yeah. And Queer as Folk.
Yeah. But we didn't really see queer sex so much, like, I'll be totally honest with you. There was, in the last season of Sex Education on Netflix, there is a queer sex scene between a trans and a non-binary person. And I was like, holy shit, I have never seen a sex scene in a TV show, especially not one on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
between a trans person and a non-binary person. Like,
yeah.
It blew my mind. I was like, holy shit, this is where we're at in 2024. In 2010, it's like lesbian sex. Ooh, no.
Yeah.
Like, that should only be implied, not like overtly displayed.
Right.
So that was another thing. That was another reason why everybody was talking about this movie. It's like, oh, they had sex. And it's like, yeah. There have been so many more graphic sex scenes in movies between a cis male and a cis female.
Exactly.
This year. Like, I can't even tell you.
Yeah.
Especially in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So that was a frustrating take on that movie. It's like, it was boiled down to this one scene. It's like, it didn't really have anything to do with that. It more had to do with, like, were they really together? Was this a sabotage?
Exactly.
A purposeful sabotage of Nina's debut? Or was this something that occurred in Nina's head?
Yeah.
Not, you know, that she had sex with her.
Right.
Because then later she sees Lily having sex with the director.
right,
on the piano, and it's like, is that even real? Like, is this something that's really happening?
And she sees her kind of feeling up one of the male dancers, right, too.
Yeah.
And again, did that really happen?
Yeah. Did you notice too, when Lily came to talk to Nina in her dressing room, that she had like metallic paint on her mm-hmm. face? It's like, what does that mean? That right. has to mean something. Like, no, none of the other dancers had weird metallic paint on their faces. Who was she making out with? Probably wasn't Vincent Castle's character, because he's not wearing makeup.
Right.
Was she making out with this other male dancer? Was she making out with the guy who's supposed to be Rothbart? Or was she kissing Nina?
Yep.
And we don't know.
Yep.
Because Nina's the only one who's wearing metallic, like, makeup on her hands and on her face.
Yeah.
It's blowing my mind. Like, the more I'm talking about it, the more I'm like, what the fuck is even real?
And her lipstick is off at that point, too.
Right. Baffling.
Yeah.
I do like that that part of it is not clearly spelled out. I think that...
I like that, too. Yeah.
That's a thing that Aronofsky does, where he does not make things as spelled out. And he gives the audience the opportunity to interpret it in their own way and make their own conclusions.
Well, let's talk about the ending then.
Let's talk about the ending.
Because the ending, to me, again, we're circling back to parallels with The Wrestler. The ending to me was so parallel with The Wrestler in both the literal leap of faith and the fact that after the leap is taken, you as an audience member get to kind of choose your own adventure about what actually happened and what the character's fate is at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Because we just cut to, we don't cut to black, we cut to white at the end of this movie. In this case, we get to see what happens after Nina leaps. The Wrestler, if I'm remembering correctly, ends with the leap.
Yes.
And we are left to assume a lot about what did or didn't happen to that character. We see Nina land, but we see what she has presumably done to herself, and we don't know, does she survive from that? Is that real? I mean, is that really real? Did that really happen? Many things.
Yeah, especially because things get really scattered. You know, like, she thinks that she's killed Lily, and then she didn't really kill Lily. Yep. She sees her mom in the audience, which, why would her mom come? You know, considering that she was like nearly late, did her mom really show up? Is her mom really there? Or is that just something that she's seeing in the crowd? And then she's like, I was perfect. You know, I was perfect. But she wasn't. Her performance was not perfect. She fell in the first act. He leaves it open for you to interpret the way that you want to.
Yeah.
Is this character going to die from her wounds? You know, like, she did stab the shit out of herself. Does Lily even exist?
Truly.
You know, like, is Lily just a figment of her imagination that she's created and sort of imprinted on this person? I mean, ostensibly she's real, but the only other person that we really see her interact with is that one other dancer who she assumed got the Swan Queen role. Is that who really is supposed to be her alternate? And Lily is just a figment of all the things that she wants to be, but she's not. So, like, none of those things really happened, and that she's just been stewing in her own juices, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's a compelling story because at the end of it, you don't know.
Right.
You don't know whether or not she really hurt herself. Is she really going to die? Did she really engineer this to happen so that she is also dying like the swan in this version that she's portraying? It's good storytelling, I think.
It really is.
To kind of leave it muddied there at the end.
Yeah.
Because it's the same thing with Beth's character.
Yeah.
With Winona Ryder's character, which we haven't even really touched on her at all. We kind of are faced with this, like, age-old character of an older man who exerts influence on these young women and then just kind of chews them up and spits them out, you know, sleeps with them, pantomimes a relationship, and then says, okay, you're too old. Now it's time for, on to the new young girl. And in this case, Beth, who we see interact with Nina at the fundraiser, it looks like, rich white black tie affair.
Yeah.
And she afterwards throws herself in front of a car, breaks her legs so she can never dance again. And then we see her in this all pink, like, hospital room, which, when have you ever been to a hospital room that's all pink?
Yeah, never.
Yeah, no, that's not a thing. And then Nina goes back to talk to her because she's stolen a bunch of shit from her. These earrings, cigarettes.
The lipstick,
which Lily also smokes. And then when she returns them, Beth takes her nail file and stabs herself in the face. And it's also like, did she really do that?
Right.
Is that really a thing that happened?
Right.
Or is this just all made up in her head of like the parallel of being in the prime of her life and taking full advantage of being a young, sexually liberated or sexually independent woman who's taking all that life has to offer, and then seeing Beth, who is now out of her kind of like maiden form and descending into crone and can't handle it.
Yeah. And like, this is what you'll become. She's right. The cautionary tale.
And then her mom, who's like fully mothered, you know, and had to give up all these things. Is she just seeing Beth in this way because she can't handle it?
Yeah.
She's like seeing, oh, this is what's going to happen to me. Either I get pregnant and I become my mom, or I don't get pregnant and then I become used up and and then discarded like Beth. Oh, so much there.
Yeah.
And it's funny that this also comes from a male director, because
I agree.
I think that there could have been a little bit more care in some of the depictions of like ballet and and the way that women interact with one another, but also a compelling tale even from a guy.
Yeah, definitely.
I did also want to say that I think that this was a very different role for Mila Kunis, and I was excited to see her in it. Even though she's not as prominent in this movie, she's certainly like a supporting actress in this movie, but it's very, very different for her because prior to this, she was doing That 70s Show.
Yeah.
And like some comedic movies, which there's one that she did with Kate McKinnon, which I think is freaking hysterical.
Oh, is that the one with Gillian Anderson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that movie. It was great. And I can't remember it, but it's very different for her. A very different, more serious role. Like, she's famous for being in That 70s Show, for getting Sarah Marshall, like really funny stuff. But this was not a funny movie. Like, she's not comedic in it at all. And I thought that I would like to see her in more stuff where she stretches herself out of that comedic role, even if it doesn't feel as good. I did read that she took this role because she and Natalie Portman are good friends. So that's part of the reason why she went with it. But I would like to see her in more stuff like this.
I agree. I think she was great in this. And she's very compelling as a dramatic actress. And I would definitely like to see her do more stuff like this.
Yeah, she also had to lose weight for this film to be a convincing ballerina. Natalie Portman had to lose weight. Natalie Portman had to undo her vocal training. I guess when she was a kid and when she was in the Star Wars movies, everybody was like, she has too much of a baby voice. So she went through like several years of doing vocal training to get her voice to be lower. And then in this movie, which especially at the beginning of the movie, like her voice is very high, very baby-like.
Yep.
So she was kind of upset. Like that was a tough part of this for her, was to undo that training. Just really altogether like pushing the limits of acting, I think, at points, and like putting yourself in the actual peril.
Yeah.
And also like seeing that portrayed on the screen was very interesting. Definitely one to check out. It's psychological. It's all of the things that Darren Aronofsky does best, but it's not going to make you feel sick like Requiem for a Dream or Mother might, you know?
Yeah.
So it's absolutely worthwhile, worth watching. A very interesting movie, and I think fully, definitely a horror film.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So we talked a little bit about Argento in this episode. So next time we're going to do an Argento-produced movie, an Italian film directed by the son of Bava.
Yeah, Lamberto Bava.
I'll characterize him as son of Bava, baby Bava. We're going to do Demons, because after this movie, which is like going to squeeze your brain a little bit, after Black Swan squeezing your brain, you want something that's going to squeeze your brain less. And Demons will definitely do less brain squeezing, but not none. Not none, though.
Yeah, Demons will embrace your brain in a warm, fuzzy horror way. But also, there are some things to mine there. There are some things that are deliberately vague about that movie that I love. But it's really like, man, you want to talk about like all stars of film here. You've got Dario Argento, Lamberto Bava. You've got Claudio Simonetti doing the score. Like, this movie has everything. It's one of my favorites.
Yes, yes. So tune in next time for sure.
Woohoo!
Thanks for listening to Attack of the Final Girls. Find us online at attackofthefinalgirls.com.
And hear bonus episodes at patreon.com/attackofthefinalgirls. We're Attack of the Final Girls on Instagram and TikTok.
Our theme music is by House Ghost and is available on Rad Girlfriend Records.
Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode, and rate and review on Apple Podcasts so more people can find the show. I'm Juliet.
And I'm Teresa. Until next time, stay scary.